You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
King Solomon is our author, writing about 3,000 years ago, and he's writing sort of a memoir of meaning. He's looking back on the breadth and the scope of his life, and he's trying to write to younger people. We see that at the end of the book, chapters 11 and 12. And he's basically saying, don't do what I did. And it's his plea to live a life for God and to live a life of meaning. So this is a guy we should know, had an incredible intellect, unbelievable wisdom. He had the mental faculties, he had the money, he had the means, he had the time. During this time in Israel's history, they were struck with a time of peace. And everyone wanted to be in Israel's pocket because they were so wealthy. And so he had time, he had the means to basically do this search of meaning. His thesis, life is meaningless under the sun. This is in a prepositional phrase that's used no less than 29 times in this book. This is basically a metaphor to describe life apart from God. So in Ecclesiastes 5, he says that God is in heaven and you are on earth. So this is under the sun, under heaven. And so he's saying, apart from God, this is the way it looks. So what this means is, if you're here tonight and you're an agnostic or an atheist, this applies to you because this is looking at life apart from God. If you're here tonight and you're a follower of Jesus Christ, this applies to you as well because sometimes you live as though God doesn't exist. And if you're anywhere in between those two polarities, this applies to you as well. Because we can move from a philosophical atheism to a practical atheism and anywhere in between. And so Solomon is trying to rouse our attention on this very subject. What about living for pleasure? Some people, as he brought together this gathering, this word, kohal, a gathering, he's the kohal eth, the preacher, the teacher, the professor. He brings together these people. And I'm sure somebody would have raised the question, well, yeah, you're saying everything's meaningless in chapter one. But I'm pretty happy. You know, I go for pleasure. I go for stimulation, excitement, and life is meaningful for me. To which Solomon replies, yeah, I've done that. Chapter 2, verse 1. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. So he's going to take on this subject of hedonism. You know what that means? An ism is a worldview, and hedon means pleasure. So a worldview surrounded with pleasure, living a life of pleasure. This is something which modern social scientists have discovered, what they refer to as the pleasure paradox, that the more you reach for pleasure, the less you're able to get it. And as soon as you get it, it seems to evaporate. Or in a more sophisticated way, they call this the hedonic treadmill. That it's kind of like being on a hamster treadmill and you're running and running and running and running and you're really trying to get more and more pleasure and yet you're still in the same place. You haven't moved at all. Don't believe me? Sonia Lyubomirsky, she's a professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. This is from her book, The How of Happiness. She writes, an impressive body of research now shows that trying to be happy by changing our life situations ultimately will not work. Why do life changes account for so little? Because of a very powerful force that psychologists call hedonic adaptation. What is that? She writes, human beings adapt to favorable changes in wealth, in housing, and in possessions, to being beautiful or being surrounded by beauty, to good health, even to marriage. Although we may achieve temporary boosts in well-being by moving to new parts of the country, securing raises, or changing our appearances, such boosts are ultimately, or rather unlikely, to be long-lasting. The primary reason is that people readily and rapidly adapt to positive circumstantial changes. Do you see what she's saying? I had a friend who was a musician, and he had this line, great line. I would have killed for this line. The line was this: a change of zip code won't change everything. Great line. Oh, man, what a great line. He was right. You could pick up and just move to a different city, and yet the problem is you're still going to be there when you get there. we quickly adapt. So you move to a new, you know, really super hip town and everything's cool and everyone's good looking and there's wealth, and quickly you will adapt to that level. So, you know, coming in out of a snowstorm and you come near a fire and you're like, oh, this fire, this feels so good. I felt like my fingers were going to fall off, you know, and you get near the fire and it feels amazing for a little bit. But then you very quickly realize that actually that fire is kind of hot and I'm kind of sweating and actually I feel kind of uncomfortable. I want to go outside into the cold. You adapt. That's the point. That's Lyubomirsky's point. That's Ed Diener's point. Professor of psychology at the University of Illinois, the late Ed Diener. He says, people who try to make themselves really happy, those folks who chase excitement in relationships, a big paycheck at work, and intense thrills in their leisure time, are a bit like rats on a treadmill, running and running, but not really getting anywhere. You see why they call it the hedonic treadmill? The more you go for pleasure, whether it's, you know, carnal pleasures, like, you know, just going out there and snorting as many drugs as you can, or as he puts it here, you know, just trying to get a raise and accomplishment and some kind of success at your job, whatever it is, whether you're a sophisticated hedonist or you're just a carnal hedonist where you're just going for the base pleasures. It's all the same, according to Diener. He says you're like a rat on a treadmill, not getting anywhere. You quickly adapt. Daniel Gilbert out of Harvard, he says, among life's cruelest truths is this one. Wonderful things are especially wonderful the first time that they happen, but their wonderfulness wanes with repetition. This is Solomon's thesis. Only it's 3,000 years before social psychology, where he's captured this. And just in case you think, well, he wouldn't really know. Like, he doesn't really know what true pleasure and hedonism is like. No, no, no. He's the expert in hedonism. He is a master of pleasure. This guy, no one's even come close to Solomon, as we'll see. So he begins, he says in verse 2, laughter is madness. What does pleasure accomplish? You see in the Hebrew, that's a parallelism. Laughter and pleasure, those are seen as synonymous. And so when he's saying laughter and pleasure, he's really referring to what? What would you say? Like, I guess comedians, like back then they didn't have Netflix, so you couldn't see the Dave Chappelle special. So he would just bring in Dave Chappelle and pay for him to come in and do his humor, his comedy, you know. In verse 8, we read, I acquired male and female singers. Think about that. Wouldn't that be amazing? Like you're like, well, they didn't have Spotify back then, that poor guy. He bought the band. He just brought him in. He's like, Chris, bring me Chris Martin and play the songs from Coldplay, but only from the album Parachutes. You know, bring me Bruno Mars, but only do Michael Jackson covers. Bring me Adele, sing nonstop until I fall asleep or cry or both. Well, he would bring in these male or female singers. Just imagine that, the talent of all the land and even from outside of Israel would come in. Entertainment. And what's he call this? Madness. What does it accomplish? Now you might say, what are you saying? Is this wrong? Is that what Solomon's saying? No. He's not saying that entertainment is wrong. Indeed. God created us to enjoy life. He made us to laugh. So there, you can put away that question, does God have a sense of humor? Yes, he does. He made us this way. It says that you weep now in Luke 6:21, but later you will laugh in heaven. We were created and designed to laugh, as we all know intuitively, don't we? That we were just made to enjoy a good belly laugh around people and just enjoy this. But here's the problem. We're not satisfied with that. We want to take that enjoyment, that laughter, that entertainment, that excitement, that dopamine rush, and we want to fuel it full of steroids. We just want to make that, you know, adrenalized, and we want it hitting our brain as fast as possible and as much as possible, with as much novelty as possible. So enter social media. This is kind of the new outlet for entertainment. Many people don't even watch television anymore. You're like, what's television? That's my point. Nobody watches it. What they do is they flip through 8-second videos. They read through, you know, 110 character messages. They go through and their political views, their philosophical views, their cultural views. The news is all through social media. This is their form of entertainment. There's just one problem. It makes us profoundly unhappy. One study by Gene Twenge out of the West Coast in 2018 was comparing people who have light internet use to those who have heavy internet use, and she found that those with heavy internet use are twice as depressed as those with light internet use. We say that's a little bit nebulous, you know, I mean, a little bit vague. I mean, internet use, that's as close as we can get to the mark. Au contraire, let's go a little bit closer to the mark. How about people who don't use social media at all versus people who use it 5 hours a day? See, I like that. I like to use the polarities, the extremes, where somebody, like, I don't know a person who never is on social media, including myself. But let's look at the extreme version, somebody who's not on it at all, and somebody who's on it all the time, 5 hours a day. They found that people on it 5 hours a day were three times as depressed as the others. That should get our attention right there. See, social media, entertainment, laughter, all this, what is it? According to Solomon, madness. That's all it is. Why are podcasts so interesting to people these days? Why is it that some of the most famous, most downloaded podcasts are those where it's just hours of a person interviewing another person? Why is that? No thrills, no bells, whistles, just one person talking to another for hours on end. Some people have hypothesized that friendship is at such a low, community is so anemic and sparse, that people like to listen to podcasts so they can listen to people have a conversation. Well, this is the hedonic treadmill, and I'd like to ask the question, are you happier now? Like, let's think about this. Just really give me an honest answer. Are you happier now that you can check Twitter every 2 minutes? Are you happier now more than you were 10 years ago when this whole social media thing didn't even exist? I mean, I honestly am asking, like, when you think to yourself, like, do you wake up in the morning and you think, thank God that I get social media because my quality of life is just so better than it used to be. Like, before I was just a wreck. I was miserable. I was sad. I was lonely. I was purposeless. And then Facebook came. And in my life, it's just great all the time. Is that how you feel? Are you happier now that you can watch a screen for several hours on end with no interruptions? Is this really making us happy? Like, ask yourself that. I really mean that with all sincerity. I know people are like, oh, I've heard about this a lot, and I've seen the documentaries on it, and I've read the papers on it. Really think about this. Like, you go home tonight, and you're like, I'm tired. I need to go to bed. I'm really tired. And then you get on your phone for 2.5 hours, and then you're like, it's 1:30, and I'm watching, you know, TikTok videos. What happened, you know? What happened was, like, you bought into this. You believe this is going to bring you happiness or a meaning to life. This is a substitute meaning. And it wears off. That's all I'm saying. That's all Solomon's saying. What about the second example of meaninglessness? He says in verse 3, I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. My mind was still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. Yes, wine. Boy, I bet he had some good stuff too. Solomon, I bet his stuff has got to be great. I remember one time I had a buddy, one time, who had a bottle of Johnny Walker Blue Label, $300 a bottle, and he poured me one shot. It was like a special occasion. I honestly couldn't tell the difference between that and the other stuff. But I mean, I was just like, yeah, this is really good. Definitely worth it. But I mean, I bet Solomon, wine, I mean, he probably had the best stuff you ever thought of. Now, again, are we saying that drinking alcohol is wrong? Is that the point here? Come on, come on, come on. If you're a Bible reader, the Bible is pro-alcohol. I know my fundamentalist friends are cringing when they hear that. Oh, don't say that. I got to side with Jesus on this. I have to do it. You know, somebody who's a fundamentalist picketing a brewery, did you know that Jesus was a brewer of wine? And you're like, well, a little bit. 150 gallons of wine at the wedding of Cana. He had such a reputation. Matthew 11:19, they called him a drunkard. Now, I don't think Jesus was a drunkard. Don't get me wrong. But he must have drank. Otherwise, that accusation wouldn't have stuck. You know what I mean? So he drank to the point where people could actually accuse him of being a drunkard, even though he wasn't, just to be clear. But he says, I'm going to drink more wine with you when we get to heaven. Like, I can't believe that. Like, having a glass of wine with JC. And he brewed it, and he's just going to be like, yeah, enjoy yourself. How about Psalm 104? God causes, there's an ellipsis there. There's these material causes like the wine or the grapes and blah, blah, blah. Anyways, point is, God causes wine, which makes man's heart glad. So there you go. To my fundamentalist friends, I say with all respect, sorry, not sorry. The Bible is pro-wine, pro-alcohol. Here's the problem. It's when we take it to its excess. Just like we wouldn't sit here and ban social media, right? That'd be foolish. Just like we wouldn't ban alcohol. We've seen that experiment. It failed. But can we have the restraint not to go over the line to the point where we're being drunk? We can't handle ourselves. The point where we can't keep it together. You know, why is it that you feel the need to get drunk? Is it boredom? It's like I got nothing better going on in my life. Is it stress? Is it that you just feel so stressed out, you just don't want to think about it anymore? Is it that you're unhappy? Maybe you're mildly depressed. Maybe you're majorly depressed. Is it that you have some kind of a relational dysfunction that when you get around people, you know, your pulse starts to rise, you get sweaty, you get kind of clammy, you get uncomfortable, you got to have your back to the door, you know, you feel that sense of social anxiety. Here's the thing. Over-drinking, or whatever the drug of your choice is, over-drinking doesn't relieve any of these symptoms. I hope you see that. The boredom, the stress, the unhappiness, the relational dysfunction, it causes these symptoms. You say, how do you figure? You know, when I'm bored and I get drunk, I feel a lot better. Look, the key to fixing the boredom in your life is not to sit there and get, you know, drink into a drunken stupor. If you want to get rid of a life of boredom, what you need to do is find a meaning to your life, something toward which you're moving. And just sitting there getting hammered doesn't fix the problem. It causes the problem. Don't you see that? What about the stress? Oh, I feel a lot better. No, you don't. Because the drunk goes away, and all of a sudden you don't have the coping mechanisms to deal with your stress. So, and with all of these, the depression, the relational dysfunction, I get so nervous being around crowds of people. So I got to go in there and drink a little bit too much before I get around people, and then I'll feel good about myself. What you're doing is robbing yourself of the coping mechanisms that you can grow and build in order to interact and enjoy all these situations, to have a meaning, to feel happy with your life. You know, you could think of it like this. It'd be like if I walked around all day and I wear size 13 shoes, okay? Imagine I wore size 6 shoes. And I walked around all day, you know, just with my toes crunched up. And finally, at the end of the day, I just, you know, oh, God, you know, pulled off those shoes. And I said, God, do I love these shoes. They feel so good when I take them off. The shoes are not making you feel good. It's that when you take the shoes off, it relieves your symptoms. The same thing is true here. It doesn't help. It hurts. So let's go back to our treadmill. Does getting intoxicated make you feel better, or does it just relieve the pain? Does it just get rid of the misery? And here's a follow-up question. Do you know the difference between those two states? You know, oh, I feel so much better when I take off those shoes because they hurt so much. That's not pleasure you're feeling. That's a relieving of pain that you're experiencing. I hope you know that. And yet we live in this realm day by day, week by week. Solomon's been there. What else does he have to say? Verse 4, he says, I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks. I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. Oh, yeah. Solomon, big builder. Big, big architect. I mean, he was smart. He was wise. Apparently, he was, you know, what do they call it? Arborist. He was a botanist. He was a scientist. He studied different species of animals and trees. And he was an architect. It's like, this is the guy that everyone wants to be. He's got it all. And he was a builder. So, I mean, he built his home. He took 13 years on that. He built the temple. Ornate. Beautiful. I mean, it's boring to read about. But then when you really think about it, he built this thing. It's like, wow, it gives you real respect. Vineyards, Song of Solomon. He talks about the vineyards that he built. Tons of towns, whole cities, infrastructure. He was so rich that according to 2 Chronicles 9, verse 27, he made silver as a currency like stones. Like walking around and like looking around on the ground and seeing a stone, that'd be like finding a piece of pure silver because of the wealth. He was so flush with gold. Indeed, what we're seeing here is that Solomon is trying to recreate Eden. Did you notice that? The parallels to Genesis 1 and 2? The garden, paradosis. Jesus uses that word in Greek in Luke 23, verse 43, where he says, "Today you will be with me in paradosis, paradise." That's the same word used here for gardens, paradise, a garden, a park, the fruit trees, the water groves, the flourishing trees. He's trying to recreate the garden. Then he says, "I've bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house." So he didn't feel comfortable enough just buying, you know, land and property. He bought people. And he says, "I owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me." According to the parallel passage, 1 Kings chapter 4, he was bringing in so much food that he could feed somewhere between 5 to 14,000 people per day. Imagine having a big party of 14,000 people. Who's invited to the party? Who's not invited at that point? You know what I mean? I mean, he was feeding everybody all day, every day. "I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings." He brought in 50,000 pounds. That's 25 tons of gold per year, not including the foreign taxes. So this guy, he'd make Bezos, Bill Gates, Zuckerberg, you know, look like penny pinchers here. I mean, he was just flush with money. I mean, what do you do when you got that much money? Well, you might be asking again, number three, is being wealthy a sin? Is this wrong? No, that's way too reductionistic. Being wealthy is a sin, is wrong? No, it's not. But, the love, the longing for wealth, that is wrong. According to 1 Timothy 6, verse 10, where it says that the love of money is a root of all evil. So the love of money and by the longing for it, many people have ruined their lives and fallen into destruction. So it's a root of evil, not the root of evil, but longing for it, desiring. It's the attitude of the heart. Paul later goes on to say that those who are rich should give generously for times of need. So it isn't the wealth, but it is the heart issue. It's also the issue of giving. He says, well, you should give. You can see this here. This wealth really twisted Solomon. Brings up I, me, myself, or my 11 times in these five verses, from verses 4 to 8. It's I, me, and my, and myself. Does money make us happy? No, it does not. You compare what are called extrinsic versus intrinsic goals, okay, with regard to their well-being or their ill-being. So on the one hand, extrinsic goals would be things like money, fame, image, extrinsic. You know what I mean? Like, people have to give that to you. Versus intrinsic goals, like things like relationships or things like community, personal growth, things that come from within me and things that I can build, things toward which I'm moving. When it comes to extrinsic goals, there's negligible impact on your well-being, hardly any, according to this study. By contrast, extrinsic aspirations had horrible consequences with regard to ill-being. So when it came to depression, anxiety, psychosomatic symptoms, you know, psycho, mind, soma, body, the way that your mind affects your body, sleeplessness, exercise, people running themselves ragged, that sort of thing. Yeah, it hurt people. By contrast, intrinsic things, relationships, community, personal growth, helped your well-being and lowered your ill-being. Yeah, that's where it's at. Relationships. We're going to build on that in the subsequent weeks. Now, are we saying that you should be dirt poor? That has the problems of its own. If you lived at minimum wage for your life, that would decrease your happiness. That would increase your suffering. Yes, it would. If you don't go out and get a career, that's going to hurt for sure. That's going to lower your standard of happiness and your ability to serve God. However, and this is a big caveat, going above $75,000 per year, and this is a study which was done over 450,000 people. That's a huge sample size. And these are in Columbus dollars. I checked the inflation rate, all that. $75,000 for a household. Anything above that, you couldn't mark any difference in happiness. None. Zero. So $100,000, $150,000, million, didn't matter. Some of the old guys, Rockefeller, they asked him at one point, he was hundreds of millions of dollars. How much more do you want to get? To which Rockefeller replied, just a little more. Oh, yeah. I'm sure if you just got another million, then you'd be happy. Solomon, in the book of Proverbs, he said in chapter 30, verse 8, give me neither poverty nor riches. Give me just enough to satisfy my needs. To be content with what you have. And so Elizabeth Landau, a reporter writing for CNN, was reporting on this middle-aged woman, lottery winner, who was a mother of three. She was working four jobs, just trying to keep above, you know, the water. And the woman said after she won that she wanted to remain anonymous. Why? She said, because I don't want anyone coming to me trying to get money, trying to hurt me. I don't know if you've ever studied this. Lottery winners get killed. They get death threats. Everyone comes out of the woodwork trying to get their hand out, get the money. She said, sometimes I wish I could change my name and go somewhere and just hide. I don't know whether happy is the right word to describe this. She said, I'm still trying to grasp it. Yeah, lottery winners, after 2 months, their happiness does spike, obviously. It goes right back to where it was. Why? Because of hedonic adaptation. Your happiness spikes, and then you go right back to where you were. Humans are very good at this, to landing right where we were. How long does it take for you before the happiness of wealth or a new purchase wears off? You get that new Amazon purchase, you click, and you're sitting there waiting. You know, the dopamine is really flying through your brain. You're excited about this purchase, and you did all the reading, and how many stars does it have? And then you're waiting there by the mailbox or, you know, your drug dealer to bring your box to you. You just can't wait for it. He finally brings you your new techie thing or whatever, and you open it up, and you see it was everything I wanted it to be. This is going to change my life. How long does that last? 2 hours? That you're happy? Like, are you sustained happy for 2 hours? Maybe. 2 days? Like, would you be happy by Wednesday based on this little get? Maybe. I don't know. Maybe. 2 months? No. Nope. No. That's not going to happen. Doesn't happen. Investing in possessions, they don't satisfy. You go right back to where you were. Think about that. Next time you're about to hit click, purchase. One click purchase. You're going to go right back to where you were. Well, Solomon rounds this out. He says, I acquired a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. And so he brings up sex. Clearly, the Bible is not anti-sex here. Read Solomon's other book, Song of Songs. Very sexy book, that's for sure. I had a friend who had a religion teacher who said that the medieval monastic monks used to read through the Song of Songs because it was so erotic and no women were around. So imagine going into that monk's little chamber and being like, hey, brother. And he's like, oh, sorry. You look at his Bible. There's a big crease right by Song of Solomon. You're like, what's going on here, man? Need some help? I don't know if that's true. I just choose to believe that it's true. I have no idea. Anyways, very erotic book. Very erotic book. Okay, here's the issue. The harem. I think we could all agree the harem, that's wrong, right? Like, we would agree that that's wrong, having a harem of women forced to sleep with you. 300 wives, yeah, I think that is immoral. And 700 concubines, I've heard my old professor used to tell me. The 300 wives, those were so they could have peace treaties with the other countries. I'm like, there were not 300 other countries in existence. There's not 300 countries today in existence, okay? Back then, there were not that many countries, so, okay, but let's just put that on the side. 700 concubines! How do you explain that? The desires of man's heart. It's basically, this is just a pornographic theater. Instead, it isn't digital, it's real. This was the 10th century BC version of Tinder. Only instead of swiping right, you just pointed right, pointed left. I'll take her. Not good, according to Solomon. He had it all. He had it all. Every fantasy you'd ever want, sexually speaking. And his conclusion is, there's no meaning here. One study found this, a study of 16,000 Americans. The happiness maximizing number of sexual partners in the previous year. Now, what do you think that number would be? Like, to have how many partners would you need to have the maximum amount of happiness in the previous year? You know, would it be like, obviously we wouldn't want to have like 100 sexual partners, right? But maybe in the last year, I think it'd be happy to what? 3, 4? Maybe you're a little bit wild. 10, you know, so maybe that would make you a little bit happier. Answer, 1. 1 sexual partner. Oh, well, that's the Americans, a Christian nation or whatever. First of all, whatever. Secondly, what about the Chinese, 3,800 Chinese? The happiness maximizing number of sexual partners is one. Huh. And then engaging in extramarital sex is negatively related to happiness. That's so weird. It's almost like Western culture or Eastern culture, doesn't matter. It's almost like we were created to only bond and have sex with one person to have maximal happiness in our sex life. Huh. Wonder where that comes from. Brian D. Earp from Oxford. He says the past decade has seen a dramatic increase in published studies on the neurobiology and neurochemistry of romantic love. Taken together, these studies suggest that the subjective state or states of, quote, being in love is intimately tied to characteristic biochemical reactions in the brain. These reactions involve such compounds as dopamine, oxytocin, vasopressin, and serotonin, and recruit brain regions known to play a role in the development of trust, pleasure, and reward. No news here, right? The involvement of similar neurochemicals and neural activities in processes associated with addiction has already been well established. Did you catch that? When you're falling in love, whatever that means, but I know you've experienced it. You felt the feelings and the butterflies and everything, and you're there. And they're saying the same neural pathways are used in addiction research. Same parts of the brain, same chemicals, neurotransmitters being fired. Scientists have drawn parallels between the naturally rewarding phenomena associated with human love and the artificial stimulation afforded by the use of addictive substances such as alcohol, heroin, or cocaine. I'm still waiting for the Hallmark card, baby, you make me feel like I'm on heroin. You're my cocaine, honey. Even normal romantic passions are chemically and behaviorally analogous to addiction. Burkett and Young from Emory University. Virtually every neurochemical system implicated in addiction also participates in social attachment processes. In a very real sense, we may be addicted to the ones that we love. Yeah, I think that makes sense. Those feelings of excitement, that thrill, the excitement of, how did you feel when you went out on your first date with your, special somebody? You look back, the butterflies, the excitement. Oh, yeah, I felt pretty good. How do you feel about going out on a date with her now? You might be like, I got the butterflies. Just wait. Just wait. And I mean the same thing. Definitely the women know this. With the guy, he shows up, he's not looking good. He's looking like a guy, and he shows up to your house, and the butterflies are just not there anymore. And you're like, what's wrong with me? Nothing is wrong. Nothing is wrong. There was novelty at first when you started to date, and now there's not novelty. And so you don't have that stimulation, that excitement. What about when you got engaged? How did that feel? Oh, really exciting. Oh, I just wanted to show my ring with all my friends and everything. It's so cool. How do you feel about being engaged right now at this moment? Do you feel anything? I remember it. I remember it was really exciting. What about getting married? The day you got married, that's a really happy day. Now, do you just wake up every day and just say, wow, oh my God, I got to call everybody. I got to call 100 people. I'm married. Oh, I got to sing it from the rooftops. No, this just goes away. It's, what do you call it? The hedonic treadmill. It disappears. So he concludes, I became greater by far more than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. It's almost like he's a scientist studying this. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for all my toil. Yet I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, and I found that everything was meaningless. It was a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. This is the guy who would know. He had the means, he had the mental faculties, he had the money, he had the time. And at the end of all this, he's just saying, it wasn't worth it. Please don't do it. So let's conclude here. Are entertainment, alcohol, money, and sex wrong? Wrong question. We've been asking the wrong question this entire time. A better question would be, are these things fulfilling? Do they bring happiness to your life? Are they meaningful? That's the question for the hedonist. Yes, there is a spike of excitement, some chemicals flare, and you feel a little blip, you know, on the radar screen of your happiness. The question is it fulfilling? Does it bring a meaning to life? Well, we can't enjoy these gifts from God until we enjoy the giver. That's the point. All of these things are good. Money, sex, music, entertainment, laughter. These are all good things. If they're in context. Solomon concludes, Derek Kidner says, this is like a lifting of the veil, that you're under the sun. And he lifts it back and he says, in verse 24, I decided there's nothing better than to enjoy food and drink and to find satisfaction in work. I realized that these pleasures are from the hand of God. For who can eat or enjoy anything apart from him? See how people read this book and they go, this is just a whirl of contradictions. He's just critiqued hedonism for, you know, 11 verses. And now at the end of the chapter, he says, these are all really good things. It's not a contradiction. Do you see the difference? Do you see it? He's saying when you enjoy these in their context, that you're not trying to make these things gods in your life. This hasn't become the ultimate thing, a God thing. It's just a good thing. That's when these things actually become very pleasurable. And they don't take over and ruin your life. As Jesus said, I have come to bring life and to bring it abundantly. If you're here tonight and you've never heard that Jesus Christ wants to come into your life to bring you joy, to bring you happiness, a meaning, sense of fulfillment, to fill that vacuous sense in your soul, you could walk out of here knowing Christ, knowing God, and all these things that you love, all of a sudden they would find their fulfillment in him.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.